Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
thermocouples and measuring the temperature of just ordinary things for use at school. So what I'll do in this podcast is go over the extraordinary, nothing absolutely special, just a standard thermocouple, your K-type thermocouple, which is good up to 1,200 minus 200 liquid nitrogen, up to 1,250 degrees. So, you know, practically you can stick it in the flame, a Bunsen flame, it could still all measure it for you. And the practical use of it in education. So, in general, it's very important that when you sort of develop science, you begin to talk about temperature. So if you heat something up, the temperature increases, and particularly water and things boil. There's this phase transition through the glass to gas or liquid to gas phase. The temperature stability is to do with the change in relative entropy of its state. And a state of matter is more a sort of a cultural thing that we define things that we build things out of solid stuff. We have a solid boat and we float in water, shear stress, and we use the wind to pull us through. But as for the temperature changes and all the detailed science, it's to do with more the entropy of particles and how particles interact. And one has to get that as a lived experience through to students. And the general way we do it is a few measurements with the thermometer and then a whole lot of book study. And the overall idea is that if you have sufficiently good instruments, you can actually have direct discovery. And I'm just playing with a thermocouple at the moment and applying a bit of averaging software to it and getting incredible accuracy around, I'd say somewhere between a 50th and 100th of a degree. That's repeatable accuracy with it. That is, if there's something on a phase transition, it's got to measure a temperature. It generally keeps it accurate to somewhere around 0.02, 0.05 as a push, you know, that's 20th of degree, 50th of degree. And in this thing, you can really start to see things that you wouldn't happen. So the characteristic route is a little bit of mock play. You know, you have a thermometer, and typically the school thermometer costs about $3, possibly $4 each. And then there's the handling and counting cost on top of that. So the effective cost of a thermometer is quite high. The accuracy, generally a student can read it till about 1 degree Celsius. Yeah, in general, you can't get them much beyond that. And so there's this whole overall process that you read and measure it. And there's sort of this distracted me. Things can be happening in their day. They look at things, they talk. There's the ruling of the graph and the entire process. Now, this is replaced with a thermocouple and a data log. And that pair of things isn't particularly new. People do have sort of dedicated data loggers and temperature probes, and again they take a certain amount to plug in, set up and go. And so there's not necessarily the immediacy of it there. You put in the wire and then you see a graph, you know, dislocated a long distance from it. So as you do, and then there's still the overhead of taking the information from the data log into your book and stuff like that. So what's happened here is that with the coming of the Internet of Things, there's been a push down a path for embedding sensors in white goods. So, you know, you can't access the sensor. So the white good's there, but it has sensors in it so that they're invisible. And so that's put away. And then environmental sensors. And the environmental sensors tend to be odd one. So you want to determine the temperature at 3 points in your roof, the humidity in your bathroom, smoke detector here. They're all around the place, and you can see the data, but you don't have your hands on the sensor all that much to move it about the place. And so the general idea of this is to build to look at the economics of this and say, look, the school environment's a unique situation for sensors in that it's basically putting as many sensors as possible in one area, so the student can just select the various sensors and put them in, and then it's all recorded for it. So they're not installed on a white good, installed in an environmental location over a long period of time. It's a short period of time, and it's the idea of getting it out relatively quickly. Now, if they're in little boxes and little pieces and bits and pieces to go together, and it's all fragmented, you don't have your unified approach. So the approach for this has been, my initial approach was to go down the line of your environmental sensor. So your environmental sensor, the major idea of that is its low power consumption. So you know, getting power to it is not that important. And then if low power consumption, if it can be reduced size, the better. Simply because if it's a big thing, it mightn't be a problem in, say, 90% of the cases of application. It'll be 10% of the application. It'll be just too big to poke in a place and set and forget. And so with environmental sensors, you sort of go down the path of a very small multipurpose board, a mobile phone battery, seems the obvious thing, LiPo battery, and sensors arranged with that. Now, that being said, there's something that you discover coming along the place, that certain sensors take up energy. You wouldn't think so, but certain sensors to take a lot of energy to run and drive. And indeed, load cells take energy, not like they're the babies, and then but thermocouples are quite complicated things. So thermocouples is your electric thermometer. And let's just stop for a brief while I discuss what a thermocouple is. So essentially, if I had a nail, an iron nail, it was a long, say, 10-inch iron nail, and I had it rammed through a jar, and pointing down, and I had a gold foil on the end of the nail. That the gold foil will pull apart from the iron nail if it becomes the end of that becomes negatively charged. It's basically called an electrometer. So if there's excess electrons, it will pull apart. Now, the classic way you do it is you either rub perspex or ebonite and charge it up, and there is a method to charging it, so may as well cover at the moment. It's taken a little while to work out what is the key factor to charge something up. And it's humidity is the major aspect of it. And then if it's humidity, it's the lack of humidity and how you deal with it. Often in Australia, it's quite humid, sort of tropical environments, thunderstorms outside. Typically, whenever you're going to teach electrostatics, a good thunderstorm in there, it's a good time to teach electrostatics. But the rubbing of the rods The way to do it is to get some dry paper towel and really wrap it around the thing very tight, and then stroke it back and forth until it actually gets quite hot. So the friction heats up, and once it heats up, it dries out, and then you get a decent charge. So you've got your Perspex rod, which has got excess or reduced electrons on it, or your ebonite rod, E, has got excess electrons. So you have your ebonite rod, which is a sort of a black sort of plastic. I suppose it must be bakelite or something. It's probably not ebony, which is a wood, I suppose. Ebonite, I don't know where it's from. And you tap it on your nail, the electric charge, the excess electrons will go onto the nail and spread out. They go on the conductor and move, flood and flood out. And it will cause the actual gold foil to move away. And you'll be able to see, say if you could see from the side of this in a glass jar, you could see it move across. Now, so another electrometer would be the actual hairs on your back of your hand. As you move it up to a Vantagraph generator, you can feel the charge, the electricity in the room, so to speak. Now, the surprising thing is that the metal is not just an array of a lattice of positive charges and electrons moving around the place. It's a complex thing called a thermosphere, and what happens is that if you were to attach a fairly decent flame to the other side, like a blowtorch to the other side, what happens is the electrons on the surface of this thing called a thermosphere. So it is a sphere, but it's a sphere in conceptual momentum space. So although we call it a sphere, it's a very physical thing, we imagine it as a physical thing, it's not a ball I could pick up. It's a sphere of points. So if you really looked at the individual sphere and magnified it, if you magnified a ball, you just get more and more in the atoms here. This is actually a lattice of points. So the real lattice, the metal is a lattice, but it's a lattice, a momentum space lattice. And that momentum space lattice is not the shape of your nail, it's the shape of a ball. You know, that, this is hard to get going. But if you heat it up, the electrons will be higher up, in a higher energy state of the thermosphere, and you'll get a potential gradient, and electrons will flow from the hot to the cold, and you will get your little plate move apart. Now, of course, this is in order to make this thing, you have to obviously connect a wire up to the other end to make a battery, because that's how you make a battery. But unfortunately, that wire that you connect up will also have the same effect. So you've got a battery, say a 1-volt battery. You can imagine it having the base of the cell is at the other end of your nail. And your only other way is connecting it with another battery, which is also 1-volt. So essentially what you have to do is you have to get two metals. So the K-type is a fairly selected metal. So thermocouples aren't ridiculously expensive, and they're not ridiculously cheap. It's a nickel aluminium alloy. You've got two different metals, and what happens is they have the same effect, but then they go to the other end and they don't become as negative. They're difference. The difference that you get. So what you do is that this all works. What matters is the temperature at your very tip. Then everything else cancels out as you go along. So you've got a whole series of thermocouples as you go up. Where it's soldered together, you've actually got your joint together. You've got the thermi surfaces touching each other. You've got to go all the way back to the other side. And you have the other, what's called the cold junction. So you measure two junctions, and you measure, you can't measure the voltage in your hot junction because it's in the flame, but you can measure the voltage in the cold junction, which is a function of the voltage, the temperature in the hot junction. And so, although the thermocouple doesn't take a lot of energy to drive, it's, you know, the you can actually get an elaborate system where you have a very hot junction and drive a little battery or a little spacecraft with thermocouples. So this is how your Pioneer and Voyager work. Of huge distances, plutonium. Is it 241? I think it's 239. I think. So 235, 238. It's a very neutron poor grade of plutonium, which just falls apart as alpha particles. It just doesn't go through its normal radioactive decay. So it's actually quite benign, plutonium-239, I think it is. You've got a big lump of that, and you put it out to the spacecraft, and it actually gets quite hot. Now, in the internet, they show you pictures of this lump, and it looks hot. Now, if it was around the place, you perhaps wouldn't notice it all that hot. It would be probably as hot as holding someone's hand or something like that. But if you were to wrap it up, and make sure the temperature can't get away, it can actually get quite red hot. So what they do is they wrap it up and make sure that the energy can only go through the thermocouple and produce it here. But the end result of this is that your thermocouples take up a fair amount of energy to run. So that's 0.1 of an amp, nothing. You know, 0.1 of an amp wouldn't really, is sort of the thing that you might get going through an LED, bright LED or something like that. So it's really, really low energy. Now, in old money, in the old days where we had valves and incandescent globes, that's just sort of like a picture, you know, you wouldn't notice that. It was wasted, you know. If it was going through you, you wouldn't notice it all that much. But nowadays, that's a lot of energy. With our energy efficient everything. And that's to keep the cold junction hot at a temperature, controlled temperature, and having that at a controlled temperature, it works things out and actually controls it and measures it for it. So there's a bucket load of electronics to measure this and produce it. So this is one of the things. So if you this is one of the things you don't know until you design it, you track it up. And you go along this thing of saying, it's going to be sort of a handheld device. Well, I can't really see, but, you know, I will get, you know, mobile phone battery, card, a few LEDs. I could switch those LEDs off, save a bit of power. But no, your thermocouple just chews through your battery. So one of the things you wouldn't want to do is, and it takes a little while for a thermocouple to stabilize. There you have it. It takes a few seconds to stabilize it. So unlike a sensor station, which is just got a resistor, and say measures a resistor for a millisecond every hour, okay, so that will be able to, as an endurance station, you've got this measuring every second, and its aim is stability to come through. And so this means goodbye to your battery. So you can buy a cheap battery, or you can buy a more expensive higher power battery. You can buy a bigger battery, but eventually the batteries kill you, and the battery is 3.3 volts, or for the new MOSFET set, you know, chipsets, let's just go along with that. And it's all, you know, LiPo has redefined what we expect out of electronics. It used to be TTL, which is 5 volts. We've gone down to 3.3. So we've got LiPo batteries and electronics, you know, which is at 3.3, and it's all perfectly fine. You know, we didn't have to really go that 5.5. I think 5.5 is the silicon transistor threshold switch voltages, which used to be, so your old transistor radios required a 9-volt battery. I don't know if anyone can remember. Can remember those. So, essentially, building this, I had this one, and I just ran it off a modern mobile phone battery, sort of a mobile phone sort of chip thing, which has a US mobile phone charger, a Wi-Fi thing, and a PLC all stuck together. So that's 3.3. And this was just chewing through the power of my thermocouple. Now, of course, thermocouples now, the little thermocouple system is now, if you buy the system by itself, lower cost than a physical thermometer. And you buy it in bulk, you can buy, I'm buying six in bulk. So I will, my little Stud station will have six thermocouples. So this is one mean system using a lot of power up against it, simply because it's so cheap, and the fact that you've got multiple ones, if one fails, you can just put it back in the system and it will report that it's failed and looked at it. And and I'll say what these go out of China, but at this one, this had a little sort of it was had a resolution of 0.25 degrees Celsius, more than enough. You know, that's a factor of two better than a student could ever do in their wildest dreams. So basically, it's five for the cheap ones, a very expensive one, which is already rated to, you know, a very high degree. So that sort of can be used to monitor and set the other ones. This is just out of experience. So already you can festoon the idea. Now, this already gets the idea is that the beaker doesn't have a temperature. There's environmental temperatures, there's temperature gradients. You can basically set yourself up to measure absolutely everything. You could even stick a thermocouple into the flame if you really, really wanted to. I have to look at that. So this is sort of a fresh approach. Now, the thing is that there's a sequence that I had. That's where you build little steps by step. And the first step was from the chip to the internet. And that took buckets of time, simply because I was sort of like what they call a newbie. I was feeling around the place, and I didn't know that PHP couldn't take spaces in it. You would think people would write a website. PHP, what it does, you know, PHP is a file type extension that sits on a website, and the server knows, sees it, it says, oh, I better execute some processes here. Thank you very much. Sort of like writing files. And I didn't know that it required no spaces. You know. So it accumulates it up. And just written it in plain text. Why written in plain text? Because when I look at the web page, I can see it's got its data. Now, this, of course, means that the web page, the web storage, is 10 times inefficient, unbelievably inefficient. But the idea is to actually build the link, sort of like building a bridge where you build the underneath support, then you build a bridge afterwards, build it across. So that's where it is at the moment. And then that's changes it into a website. And I just, so the idea is that you could build a Java code to be nice and user-friendly, but that's too quick, too early. It's much better to actually use LabVIEW, which is a robot writing software, graphical software, which writes C++, but it uses G, a graphical program, where the actual components and subroutines are all managed for you, as with wires and connectivities and globals and all that type of stuff is all done for you. And that took a while. And where it took a while is that this is a string file, and I've got to move it slowly towards a binary file. So a string file is where you say 110 is what ASCII 1, ASCII whatever it is, 1, ASCII 0, ASCII space, something like that. So the, before you know it, you've got four, just what's probably 8 bits of data. You're using 32 bits at least, and it is slow as a wet wheat. So if it's like people sort of expect, it's really interesting. My father wrote the first computer language where people said, you know, do people really want, you know, people at the time were saying, look, you're mad. People will not want to actually program in plain English. You know, that you are mad. I'm doing sort of the opposite, sort of programming in plain English with the idea of going back to the future, back to them. So I'm up to that stage. And just to get everything working, I now then write the program that if it uses the string file, it converts it to a binary file and stores the binary file as well. And then if it checks if I've got a binary file or a string file, I'll use the binary file instead. Or if I've got a string file, I'll write a binary file to it. And so there's a few errors on that. And so I've had to, took me a while to do it. So this is one of the problems, that when you have a robust error-proof way of doing it, that when you fix something up, you can be going along, but your errors can be sort of, you have to flush everything out to get your errors. So I had a few errors back in, and that that tweeted me. Now, so you've got the idea of a student and things carried out, and now you've got everything in one place, and it's the Internet of Things, and it just automatically, when it's switched on, it's writing to its web page, but that's what it does. And then your software can go up and interrogate the web page. And so what quite often happens is my computer crashes or goes off. I switch it off to do something else. I come back. The data's still there because there's this little chip and it's just writing to the web. Now I'll have to get it to write to the web, not in ASCII, but in binary, which I can do. It's just that I then don't know how to read a web binary file. You can write to binary, but yeah, it just really doesn't make sense, quite a lot of sense to me. Now, there was the issue here of how do you manage a binary file? I've got a binary file, the arbitrary length. How do you do it? Well, you obviously need to require some sort of header. And so I was converting the binary information into the header, and of course there I wrote a nice header for a binary file of arbitrary, and I just couldn't work out. So this is the pretty much the same similar type of thing to the MP3 technology, in which you've got binary data in a chunk, but it's in a wrapper, it's in a header tail wrapper, but I didn't have that. So I've gone down a different route of writing a satellite file to the binary file, and so it, when it gets to the binary file, it looks up the satellite file and it tells it, you know, what's in the binary file, so it can open up. And the end result of this is that I can get streams of data, and it takes about a fraction of a second to put down several million points on a graph. Now, then my love view began to slow down, and what it is even your Radeon AMD super chip just can't do that number of anti-alias. There's a lot of computational power in actually just drawing a line in non-graphic software. You know, it's it's, you know, graphics is for vision, so it's got basically a bottom line that's there. And so the obvious thing to do is to average it. And my averaging routine is a fairly simple one. So you've got your matrix, your array, and what's called decimate array. So that's make an array of even and an array of odd. And it's not a link, this is just a machine language subroutine that LabVIEW has. And you decimate it, and then you add it. And so what happens is you're adding the first and second, third, fourth, all the way through. And you do that for the actual data and for the time. So that what it means is that you are now moving to the average. You get the average value with an average time, so you don't lose. Your averaging doesn't sink or shift. Your averaging sort of pulls the data around a mean time. Mean time in. And once you've got that, you can just say zero, don't do it at all, and then 1, 2, 3 to 8 or 10, I suppose, the most I've done is do it. Several, you know, 10 times over, so that's 1,000, get 1,023 data points. Now, doing this smooths, I was looking at, how you look at the data, what can you assume about how the data goes and what smoothing algorithms you would do for it. So I've done this for robot control, your hand guard robot control. So the hand guide, just the way it is, people are very, even the best people are quite shaky. And so basically you've got this really curvy little point, and I fit for that curvy input a line to it. So it looks as though everyone is a master pro in terms of bringing in something beautifully and pick it up. You feel like a zen sword artist picking things up with these robots. So I looked at that. And you got the basic aspects of it. That is a temperature differential, a response time, a basically F equals ma. So the force is the difference. The mass is the thermal inertia. Now these thermocouples are much smaller thermal inertia. They've got a fraction of a second thermal inertia. And so the end result is that I couldn't really get anything which would fit it too well. But the thing is that it now averages perfectly. And so I'm beginning to see these effects. So I'm just running it all the time there with different things. I have a hot water, cold water. Now, I was thinking, what I'll do is I'll put a spoon in my hot water and can see the gradient change, because this is so perfect. It's getting. I think I'll call it. People would say it's got 1/100 degree accuracy. Now, put 1/100 degree accuracy in a student's hand, and so that they can focus on the interpretation of the science. It's going to be a winner, but. There are these things. I've written the spoon in. The temperature jumps up a little bit because it's bringing some of the hot water on the top of the thing down. Now, of course, this would be done if you've got two thermocouples. You put them at one high, one low. You can see the different effects going on. So the lower one will cool more slowly. The hot one will cool more quickly, and you could see that too slow. And the idea was that I put in a spoon or so, and you could actually see just the ever so slightest cooling rate increase as the temperature goes up. And what you would say is that basically the electrons rush down the spoon, and this is the important thing, is that as a thermocouple measures temperature, conduction of heat in a metal is an electron thing. It's all the Fermi surface. It's not like all the things you teach at schools, is not correct. So it's a hard thing to go. And there's another thing that I had some frozen, some cool water, and there's this phenomena that I've just did. It decided to sit at precisely, absolutely 6 degrees Celsius. Now, you expect something to be beneath zero, go up, and level, be level as the ice. What's going on here? And it is something here that you get all these phenomena. Now, of course, there's things I'm not saying about this. So what I'm doing is just basically taking standard off-the-shelf stuff and doing some basic logic, and it's coming. It's like quantum mechanics coming. It will come to a school lab near you soon. And of course, I'm not. There's sort of two areas which I think which will take it up that next level. So besides having a hundredth of a degree accuracy in coming near, besides having six measures, pressure measures, pH measures, it's not only that, it'll be accurate to microgram. I do say so. I think it will be accurate to microgram. The temperature will be calibrated to national standards. I think I can guarantee that. And look, the students will get the real deal really quickly with a lot of variables, levers that they can pull in this device, and it can be wrapped up, stored away. No worries, sort of the ideal process. So there's looking at this, I can talk about it. So someone else may come out with it. Good luck to them, because I will get there. The key learning thing is that there's some two key bits of kit that I'll add to it. If it's ever going to be commercialised, I'll make it a bit better. So that's a story now, and it's quite a bit chilling. These things happen. Like, I build the Einstein to Hass, and it's away. They're sitting there. I'll get back to it to check, to have a sanity check on it. I built this, and waiting for the next bevy of parts to come in for China, which are indeed cheaper and much more powerful, because I'm not trying to do what's not meant to be done. And what's not meant to be done is that essentially, I think, a thermocouple and mobile phone battery, that's just a bad combination to go across. So I'll get there, but it always seems to happen that I reach a point where I just have to sit back and just let it percolate and work on itself, similar to the podcast software which I'm doing at the moment. I've just got the microphone, the software going, and I just have to settle down and sort of stop tweaking the software and just publish and push, and hopefully this will get out there. So hopefully these clear cubes of teaching, the observe, reason, and conceptualize cubes, the auric cubes, will be coming to you soon. And if you're listening to this podcast, you've listened to the designer just plodding through, sort of nothing great, nothing special. And I do make the full suite of mistakes anyone else makes. I think possibly having very few friends helps. You've got very few people to discuss it with and get you distracted with it. And then when people oppose it, they oppose it so vehemently. They say, people won't pay $60 for that. They'll spend more money on people that they trust. Your hands go up. So thanks a lot for listening, and I'm going to do the next podcast on reading Australasian science.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.